From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, what's happening on the ground in Iraq? We talk with Michael Gordon, chief military correspondent for the New York Times, who's just returned from Baghdad. He'll talk about efforts to stem the violence in the Iraqi capital and the potential impact of withdrawing American troops. Also, Richard Sloan. In his new book, Blind Faith, he questions the methodology of studies suggesting prayer and worship help cure illness. He says doctors should be wary of bringing religion into their medical practice. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews news shows premiering this week on network television. We're halfway through November sweeps. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. President Bush has made it clear he understands American voters are frustrated with the war in Iraq. He met yesterday with leaders of the Iraq Study Group, the bipartisan panel headed by former Secretary of State James Baker and former Congressman Lee Hamilton, to explore policy options on the war. Democratic congressional leaders have said they want American troop withdrawals to begin in 4 to 6 months, but the president cautioned yesterday that any military options must depend on conditions on the ground in Iraq. For a look at what's happening on the ground and what military leaders think about policy alternatives being discussed, we're checking in again with Michael Gordon, chief military correspondent for The New York Times. He's the author with General Bernard Traynor of the book Cobra II, The Inside Story of the Invasion and Occupation of Iraq. Gordon returned recently from several months in Iraq. Well, Michael Gordon, this is a time when a lot of people in Washington are beginning to rethink Iraqi policy. And you wrote in a piece recently that the military actually embarked on its own effort in September to assemble some of its best minds to begin considering what some alternatives might be. Who are some of the folks that the Army taps for this, and are there new ideas that they're offering?
Well, it's interesting what's happening in Washington now, because for the longest time, the Bush administration insisted that they had a good strategy for Iraq. In fact, they called it a strategy for victory. They talk about it in somewhat less ambitious terms now. But nonetheless, they started out with a strategy for victory, and the officials and the military were reluctant to acknowledge that they were doing any work on a plan B, because that might indicate that the strategy for victory wasn't going to be successful. Well, now, particularly in light of the election, everybody is advertising that they're doing new thinking, recognizing that the initial strategy basically failed and needs to be adapted at a minimum. And the military is very much like that. So General Pace, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was saying recently that stressing that he's taking a new look at our strategy in Iraq. And really what has happened is in the September time frame, General Pace pulled together roughly a dozen or so officers and gave them the task not only to look at Iraq, but also Afghanistan and other areas in the Middle East and Southwest Asia, and kind of brainstorm and come up with new ideas. What's interesting to me is these are people who have been on the ground in Iraq, who have fought there, at least many of them are, fought there and had some success there, spent a significant amount of time there. For the Army, it's a year-long tour. For the Marines, it's 7 months, and sometimes these people have spent several tours there. So these are some of the brainier, more innovative guys in the military, and they've been pulled together in what is still a pretty close-hold operation. No one's talking too much about what they've come up with, but what I've been told is that they're not looking for the lowest common denominator. They're not trying to produce a consensus document that all 13 or so of them can agree on, but rather throw out an array of ideas that General Pace can select from in advising the president.
You know, you wrote in early October, apart from this effort that you just described, you wrote in early October that the Army and Marines were finishing work on a counterinsurgency doctrine that makes the welfare and protection of civilians an essential element of military strategy. And I'm wondering, has that doctrine affected the practice of soldiers and Marines in Iraq that you can tell?
Well, that effort actually should be formalized any day now. I was writing from an earlier draft of the document, sort of really essentially the final draft, and it will officially be released, very soon. I think the drafting of the new counterinsurgency doctrine is an important step in changing the culture and mindset of a lot of people in the Army and Marines, but I think it is more informed by the experience in Iraq than informing it. And by that I mean, for 3 years now, the American military has been in Iraq, and when you're out there, you see a lot of units, and they know all this, and they've learned. That if you want to win over the population, you have to be very discriminate in the use of force, and that it's important to get the Iraqis to do as much as possible. And the doctrine is really drawn on the lessons of Iraq, but it's with an eye toward training the American military for Iraq and future contingencies, because whatever you think of all the different recommendations in Washington, I suspect we'll be in Iraq for years to come in one capacity or another.
You know, there was a set of pictures that were going around on the internet, and I think that it may have been captioned something like pictures you won't see in the New York Times, but there were a series of photographs from Iraq which showed civilians expressing enthusiastic support for American presence and posing in friendly ways with American troops. And I wonder what your impression is of the extent to which Iraqis welcome and value the American presence. I'm sure it varies around the country, but what's your sense?
Well, first of all, those are pictures you would find in the New York Times. But there was a drive-by killing, and I was with a captain who was trying to meet with the Iraqi police and stop these sorts of killings and find out what they're all about. And we were leaving the Iraqi police station, and there was a woman sitting there, standing there, and very sad expression on her face with an old man. They'd been there all morning. No one was paying the slightest attention to him. Turned out it was the wife of the guy that was killed. She was just trying to get into her own police station and get a document so that she could get the body of her slain husband and bury him. No one was giving her the time of day. So this American captain, Albertos, he was coming out, and he says, "What's this?" And the interpreter, the terp as they call him, says, "Well, this is the wife, and that's the father." And he says, "What do they want?" He says, "Well, they just want a piece of paper so they can get her husband's body out of the morgue." So the captain turns around, goes back into the police station, and he talks to the Iraqi policeman and says, "Listen, can you give her this paper?" And the guy says, "No problem, can do." But you just got the feeling that this was just going to go into some big in basket somewhere and nothing would happen. So this American captain said, no, we're going to take care of this right now. So he grabbed this Iraqi police commander. He took the wife and the father, and we all headed off to the Yarmouk Hospital together. And he said, we're gonna get this solved and squared away right now, because I think he had the sense it wasn't going to happen. So we get to the hospital. Again, a lot of run around. There's nothing we can do. You need this, you need that. American captain says, "Where's the morgue?" He marches to the morgue, presents the document, and there's a problem for Iraqis even to retrieve their dead, and this is the problem. They're fearful that the very people that killed, you know, their relatives will be watching the hospital, so they to see the relatives, because they know the relatives will come to get the dead, and then they'll target the relatives. So they're in jeopardy sometimes when they go to the hospital to get their dead. And also there's concern that some of the ministries, the health ministry in particular, is run by the more radical Shiite elements. But anyway, we got the body back. They put it in a kind of a plywood casket, strapped it to the hood of a Chevy Caprice, which was their car. And then the Americans' Stryker vehicles provided the escort across the city so she could get to some protected area and bury her husband. It was very unfortunate, I thought, that it took American intervention for this woman to safely retrieve the body of her dead husband and get him to a cemetery to bury him. And I have to think, I don't know what she thinks now, but I have to think that there's some measure of gratitude, at least if not to the American forces, who she may blame for this whole problem, at least to that captain who took the time to help her out in her distress when nobody else would.
My guest is Michael Gordon. He is chief military correspondent for the New York Times. Also, he is also author with General Bernard Traynor of Cobra II, The Inside Story of the Invasion and Occupation of Iraq. Well, I want to talk a bit about some of the policy alternatives that Americans are now going to be exploring in Washington now that the elections are over, and the American public seems to have sent President Bush a message of disapproval about the Iraq war. Of course, the Iraq Study Group is going to be This bipartisan group is going to be looking at policy alternatives. It spoke this week with the president and some senior administration officials. And a lot of Democratic leaders in Congress are saying they will press to begin withdrawing troops in 4 to 6 months. Republican Senator John McCain says he thinks more troops are needed. Do the military leaders you speak with think they can succeed in Iraq with fewer troops?
No. I think that, I think, you know, the military as an institution has a variety of voices and opinions, just as the media does and just as the political class does. So there's no one viewpoint within the military. But I think that most of the people I've talked to who've been in Baghdad think that the notion of reducing American forces there on a fixed timetable is not useful. And I, too, see some problems there. I mean, the situation in Baghdad is pretty precarious right now. And the situation in Al-Anbar province in western Iraq, take it the provincial capital, Ramadi, that's essentially up for grabs. And I don't see how having even fewer forces in the near term makes that situation more secure. You know, for years people have been complaining that Rumsfeld didn't send enough troops, which I believe is true. And now that we're in a very critical phase of this operation in Baghdad, people are saying, well, we need to have fewer troops. So I'm not quite sure how I follow the logic of that argument, especially if you're doing it on a fixed timetable. If something has to happen in a few months, well, then the argument becomes, the people who propound this view, that, well, the reason we need to reduce is to prod the Iraqis to do more so that their security forces can take on more responsibility. Well, we've already seen that their security forces don't always acquit themselves well. So just turning things over to them might encourage the prospects of civil war more than reduce it. I mean, Iraq is a very, very complicated place. And what concerns me a little bit is that some of these policy alternatives that are being discussed in Washington seem to be fashioned with an aim to gaining a consensus of what might be acceptable in Washington, not necessarily what would work best in Iraq.
Michael Gordon is my guest. He is chief military correspondent for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining me, my guest is Michael Gordon. He is chief military correspondent for the New York Times, and he's author with General Bernard Traynor of Cobra II, the inside story of the invasion and occupation of Iraq. You know, I guess there are something like 140,000 troops in Iraq now. Is that about right?
It's about right. It fluctuates because we're in a transition phase where the 4th Infantry Division is going to be coming out, and the 1st Cavalry Division's coming in, and so there's a bit of overlap while that occurs, but, you know, it's in that range of 140 to 150.
Well, you know, I just think back to the mid-60s in Vietnam when you had a small American presence go to a substantial American presence, and as it went poorly, you know, more troops were added to try and stabilize the situation until, by, I guess, 69, you had 540,000 American troops, and it still didn't go well. And I guess I'm just wondering, those who look at the impact of increasing the American presence in Iraq, would doubling the troops make a big difference? Would you have to triple the amount of troops? What are people thinking?
Well, if you look at the number of forces we have in Iraq, what's really striking is it's stayed pretty constant. I mean, it's fluctuated between 150, 140, down to, you know, towards 100, but it's always been within that kind of range. So my sense is the reason we have the current number of troops in Iraq is not because it's the correct number. It's not. It's too few if you really wanted to secure Iraq. But it's because all we're capable of deploying, because our army is too small for all of the missions that's been thrust upon it. We haven't even talked about Afghanistan, That's beyond the scope of this conversation, but Afghanistan's become a very difficult situation. NATO's involved in there. There are 20,000 American troops in there, and they're probably not enough. In fact, the senior British commander in Afghanistan recently said that implied that they needed more forces there. As he put it, if you want to win quicker, you need more forces, because he's trying to be politic and not saying they don't have enough. So we have the number of forces we have in Iraq because of it reflects more the size of our own military more than the requirements of Iraq. And I think certainly in the past we should have had more if our goal was to secure Iraq and fight the insurgency. Really the hope and the calculation on the Bush administration's part, and I think among many of the people in Congress, has been while we need more forces, we're going to rely on the Iraqis to provide the increased number of troops. That's been the Bush strategy, that's been General Casey's strategy, and I think that's the Democrats' strategy. The question McCain, I think, and others are asking is, what if they don't provide those extra troops? And the issue they're putting on the table is, would it be worth a sort of a one-time increase in Baghdad? Let's say, increase 50% or 100%, I don't know. And just to try to finally gain hold of the situation there. If you wanted to do it, and I don't think we're going to do it, but if you wanted to do it, it could be done by extending the troops that are currently in Baghdad as the new division comes in, because as I said, we don't have enough forces to do it otherwise. You'd have to prolong the deployment of the guys in Baghdad. That's the issue McCain is surfacing. The thing is, the election seemed to cut in the other direction. It seemed that the public is yearning for a way to extricate ourselves out of Iraq, not for a greater involvement. And there may be a bit of a paradox there, which is that there is no easy way out of Iraq, and you may have to get a little more involved in the short run in order to extricate yourself in the long run.
I don't want to leave without just taking stock a bit of Donald Rumsfeld's tenure at the Department of Defense. Of course, he was known for trying to reshape the American military to be a leaner, lighter, quicker force. It's acknowledged that he seems to have made some mistakes in Iraq, not bringing in enough troops, particularly after Saddam Hussein fell. You write about that in your book, failing to bring the 1st Cavalry Division in. But I'm also curious about looking at Iraq more broadly, whether you think the experience there renders any verdict for Rumsfeld's vision of the American military. Did he make the kind of military that he wanted to, and what does the experience there tell us about how effective it was?
Yes, it's a very good question. And one thing I would say is that Rumsfeld's vision of what the American military ought to look like was not Rumsfeld's alone. It was also President Bush's vision. People forget that as a candidate, Bush campaigned on a platform that he was going to bring transformation to the American military to essentially create a leaner and more lethal military. And he gave a famous speech, at least famous to people in defense circles, maybe nowhere else, at the Citadel in 1999, where he laid out this vision. And in fact, he said, I'm going to appoint a strong defense secretary to carry this out because I know it's going to involve changing a lot of the bureaucracy and culture of the Pentagon. So the president himself chartered this course. My sense is that there's some merit to that. I mean, getting the services to work together better, what they call jointness, I mean, that certainly is a good thing, and taking advantage of high technology weapons and precision weapons and reconnaissance systems, that's good if you want to be effective. But, you know, the problem was President Bush and Don Rumsfeld were so wedded to this vision of what the military ought to look like in the future that it really led them astray in Iraq. And, in fact, it's one reason why we have this mess in Iraq. Because, you know, a force that's leaner and meaner, that's great when the goal is to get to Baghdad quickly. And the precision weapons come in very handy when you're trying to destroy, you know, the Republican Guard. But once you topple the regime, mass has to substitute for speed. And it doesn't matter whether you got to Baghdad in 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 4 weeks. Once the regime is toppled, you have effectively taken ownership of that country. And in order to secure that country, you just need lots of troops to do that. It's a very labor-intensive task. The precision weapons can't compensate for that. The reconnaissance systems can't compensate for that. All the whiz-bang gadgetry won't do the job. You need folks to close the borders and seal them so the jihadists don't get in. You need to provide security in the Iraqi capital so that the people feel they can walk on the street without being molested by criminals, and they look on the occupiers at least as a competent force that can protect them. You need to provide enough security that different sects don't have to create their own militias. Why did the Shiites begin to form Shiite militias? Because they're being attacked by Sunni insurgents, and we didn't have enough forces to stop that. It doesn't fit nicely with Rumsfeld's vision of a transformed military that's smaller and which relies more on technology. So he left office with, a pretty considerable tension and some confusion, really, in terms of American defense policy, which I don't think is really going to be sorted out anytime soon.
Well, Michael Gordon, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you.
Michael Gordon is chief military correspondent for The New York Times. He's the author with General Bernard Traynor of the book Cobra II, The Inside Story of the Invasion and Occupation of Iraq. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's Complete Sherlock Holmes, in stores and online at bn.com. From the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at cabotcheese.com. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, can prayer and religion cure disease? Richard Sloan's new book, Blind Faith, questions studies linking prayer and health. And David Biancooley on the TV shows premiering this week. We're currently in the middle of November sweeps. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest Richard Sloan is troubled by the growing belief among Americans that worship and prayer can help prevent or cure disease, or in some cases even substitute for traditional medical treatment. Sloan acknowledges the comfort religion brings to many people in times of difficulty, but he questions studies purporting to show that distant prayers help cure illness or that regular attendance at religious services promotes health. Sloan is particularly skeptical of physicians who believe medical exams should include a spiritual history of their patients' lives. Richard Sloan is a professor of behavioral medicine at Columbia University. His new book is called Blind Faith, The Unholy Alliance of Religion and Medicine. One of the points you make in the book is that typically when one investigates the efficacy of medical treatments, you do clinical studies in which there are, in which both the recipients of the treatment as well as those who are giving it don't even know in some cases who's getting the placebo and who is getting the actual treatment. That's why they're called double blind. It's very hard to do that in a lot of the questions involving faith in medicine, right? Why?
It's impossible with one exception. The problem is that in the conventional randomized clinical trial, both the investigator controls administration of the treatment agent under evaluation. And so some patients with the medical condition receive the treatment, others don't receive the treatment. Nobody knows, neither the investigators nor the patients know whether they're receiving it or not. And then you measure the outcomes. The problem with studies of religion and health, by and large, is that you can't control assignment to being religious or not religious. You can't make a group of patients religious, half of them religious and half of them not religious, and then follow them for 10 years and see whether the ones who were made religious do better than the ones who don't. And so in the absence of that ability to control, all you can do is look at people who differ in the index of interest, religiosity, for example, self-reported church attendance, reading the Bible. You look at those who vary in this dimension and then see whether they perform differently, whether they do differently, whether they survive longer or whether they develop less heart disease, or if they have heart disease, develop fewer complications. The problem is that those people are self-selected. The people who are religious differ in many other respects beside their religiosity from those who are not religious. And it's extraordinarily difficult to tease apart which factors may contribute to the difference in the outcomes as a result of that kind of self-selection.
You often read or hear people say that there are a number of studies that show that regular attendance at religious services is associated with better health. And you look in particularly at one of them that's better known. It's based on interviews of almost 100,000 people from Washington County, Maryland, which concluded that regular attendance at religious services was associated with longer lives and better health. What did you find inadequate about that study?
This study provides the classic example of the failure, initially at least, to recognize that another factor may be responsible for the outcome variable. You're right, 100,000 or so residents of Washington County, Maryland were surveyed in the 60s, and then in the early 70s they were examined to see how many of them were still alive, and the reports indicated that those who in the 1960s reported that they attended church services more frequently were more likely to survive than those who reported that they attended church services less frequently. Several years later, the lead author of this study published another report essentially retracting these findings, suggesting that he failed to consider a critically important factor, which we refer to as functional status, which means how sick people are to begin with. Those people who in the 60s were initially functionally disabled, where they were sicker than the others, were the ones who were less likely to go to church. And they were also, of course, more likely to die. So rather than having a religious factor contribute to a survival difference or a health outcome, it was that a health outcome was influencing the capacity to go to church. Those people who were too sick couldn't get to church, and they were the ones who were more likely to die.
One of the points you make is that those who advocate religion as a means of achieving better health overstate the number of studies which tend to positively associate religion and health.
Yes, there's a quite a gross overstatement of the number of studies. Some reports say there are 1,200 studies. Others say 800, 900. It depends upon when you read the reports. Yes, in fact, there are a great number of studies that are about religion and health, but a far smaller fraction of those are actually about the benefits of religious devotion for health. There were comparisons of denominational differences, Jews versus Christians, Catholics versus Protestants. Others were about health fairs in religious settings. Others were about the impact of religion on medical decision-making. Still others were about religious devotion, religious involvement as an outcome variable. For example, when some people become catastrophically ill, their religious beliefs may change. They may become more devout. They may become less devout. None of those other studies is really related to the issue of the benefits of religious devotion for health.
Now, there, of course, are some that do directly attempt to answer that, those questions related to that. And one of them that you talk about is a fairly well-known study at the Pacific Medical Center in California of 40 AIDS patients. And this was interesting. They randomly assigned half of the patients to receive assistance from distant healers, people who were off-site, didn't know these people, but they were rabbis, Native American spiritualists, psychics, and they did whatever they thought would be helpful for this person to promote their healing. And then the study found that at the end of it, those who had received the benefits or the attempted benefits of the distant healers did better, at least as measured by fewer AIDS-related illnesses and shorter hospitalizations. Now, is that evidence convincing?
No. We have a paper that's just recently published examining the methods of in these studies, and there are some fundamental problems with studying the effects of distant intercessory prayer. Now, we talked about the problem before about in most studies of religion and health, you can't take a group of people and make half of them religious and half not, and so you have to rely on pre-existing differences. The one area in this field where you actually can conduct a randomized clinical trial is these studies of distant intercessory prayer, because you can assign at random some people to receive the prayers of the intercessors and others not. And on the surface, that appears persuasive. You can actually control the exposure to prayer. But in fact, you can't control the exposure to prayer. You can only control the exposure to the prayer of the intercessors that you select. But you don't control the prayer from friends, family, other relatives, co-workers, community members, members of a religious congregation, members of congregations from around the world who pray for all the sick all the time. And so in the absence
meaning that some in the control group may have been receiving intercessory prayers that you don't measure?
A great many in the control group are undoubtedly receiving the prayers from others, and we have no idea how many prayers they receive and how many prayers those in the control in the experimental group receive. And in the absence of that knowledge, we can never draw any conclusions about whether these studies can be effective or not. So that's one fundamental problem. Another fundamental problem in these studies, in these intercessory prayer studies, and in the other studies and more generally, is the failure of the scientists to make specific predictions about what the outcome variables are. In these studies of intercessory prayer, far too often the experimenters examine dozens of outcome variables, most of which are never significant, and then only one or two turn out to be significant, and they say, aha, there it is. And this is a significant methodological failure best described by what physicist Robert Park refers to as the sharpshooter's fallacy. The sharpshooter's fallacy is that the sharpshooter empties the six gun into the side of the barn and then draws the bullseye. That's a violation, a fundamental violation of scientific methods. You have to specify in advance what your hypothesis is, what variable you're going to test, and then you test it. And if it works, good. And if it doesn't, well, too bad.
Our guest is Dr. Richard Sloan. His new book is called Blind Faith, The Unholy Alliance of Religion and Medicine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining me, my guest is Dr. Richard Sloan. He has written a book called Blind Faith, The Unholy Alliance of Religion and Medicine. You know, one of the studies that you write about is called the MANTRA 2 studies, and I forget what the acronym for MANTRA is, but this was aimed at looking at the benefits of various spiritual activities on people's health. And this study concluded that intercessory prayer had no effect. And yet you write that, when, as it got reported in the media, it seemed almost as if the opposite conclusion were drawn.
The problem is, this is a problem that occurs widely in science, that research reports sometimes appear in the press long before they appear in the scientific literature. To appear in the scientific literature requires that you go that the paper go through peer review, and sometimes that takes a long time. Sometimes the paper is rejected by one journal and goes for review by another, et cetera. And eventually it appears. But before that, discussion of it may take place in the media, and the media coverage of the MANTRA study suggested that, in fact, there were effects of the distant intercessory prayer, when, in fact, when the report finally emerged in the scientific literature, it was clear that there weren't.
One of the interesting things I found about that MANTRA 2 study was that while it debunked the idea that distant intercessory prayer had had an effect on health, it did find that those patients who received what was described as music-guided imagery and touch therapy did seem to do better. I mean, does that tell us something about spirituality and health?
I don't think it tells us anything about spirituality and health. It tells the interesting thing about that finding is that you're talking about an intervention there at the bedside, in which somebody comes in and interacts with the patients, in contrast to the distant prayer where there are intercessors at some great distance away from the patients. So there may be something about engaging in some supportive interaction with patients prior to and immediately following a medical procedure that may have an outcome. And that's probably worth exploring. And, of course, some people do explore that. The problem with the MANTRA study is discussion of the findings almost exclusively revolved around the intercessory prayer outcomes and not these other outcomes.
My guest is Dr. Richard Sloan. He's written a new book called Blind Faith, The Unholy Alliance of Religion and Medicine. You know, apart from looking at the data and the scientific methodology in claims of the benefits of religion and health, I think a lot of people think it makes intuitive sense, at least parts of it. I mean, the notion that people who attend a religious service regularly have an hour or two a week where they sit and engage in a quiet, contemplative activity surrounded by a supportive community, and that can only be good for your mental health. It can only reduce stress. Doesn't that make sense in a way?
Well, it does make sense, but the people attend religious services for a great many reasons. Garrison Keillor is reported to have said that anyone who believes that sitting in church makes you a Christian must also believe that sitting in a garage makes you a car. people go to church for any number of reasons, social reasons, out of loneliness, out of habit, to make business connections. Religious devotion is certainly one of them, but it's attending church is a complex phenomenon. Nobody disputes that religion provides comfort to people in times of difficulty, whether it's illness-related or otherwise. That's not in dispute. The question is whether medicine can add anything to that, and I think the answer is no. People ought to be entirely free to practice their religion in any way they see fit in medical contexts. And physicians need to know about that, but physicians shouldn't use that information to base interventions on.
Some would say you shouldn't proselytize religion, you shouldn't advocate a faith, but that you do your patients a favor by suggesting that they focus on positive spirituality, you know, things that we all agree would be good, you know, honesty, self-control, joy, love, hope, generosity. What about that school of thought?
Well, you know, that's wonderful advice. Our mothers all gave us that advice. The problem is we don't have any idea whether that's related to health. We don't know whether people who are joyful and honest live longer than people who are cynical and dishonest. We just have no idea. It doesn't seem to me that that's the business of a physician to be making those kinds of moral judgments. That is the legitimate business of the clergy to make those kinds of recommendations, but not physicians.
Do you think there's a concern that if someone tends to look at their physical health and what's happening in their physical life as a consequence of their relationship with God, that they will, in effect, blame themselves for an illness?
That's clearly the case. If you blame yourself as a result of some failure, then you may increase the risk of becoming sick. Certainly, you increase the distress that you experience in a way that's not conducive to better health. Let me give you an example of that's related to this. One of the significant ethical issues associated with attempts to connect religion and health, the possibility that you can actually cause harm. About my first foray into this field of religion and health was more than 20 years ago when I was interviewing young women who were about to receive the results of gynecologic biopsies to determine whether or not they had cervical cancer. And I was interviewing a woman in a semi-private room. She was separated by a thin curtain from the other patient, also awaiting the results of her biopsy. And this other patient had her family with her. And while I was interviewing my patient, the biopsy results for the other patient came back, and they were negative. And her father exclaimed to nobody in particular, "We're good people. We deserve this." Now, that's a perfectly reasonable thing for the father of a potentially sick young woman to say. Perfectly reasonable. But what was the young woman I was interviewing supposed to say to herself when her biopsy came back positive? Was she supposed to say, "I'm a bad person. That's why I got sick. I've been insufficiently devout. That's why I got cancer"? It's bad enough to be sick. It's worse still to be gravely ill. But to add to that the burden of guilt or remorse over some supposed failure of devotion is simply unconscionable. But that's precisely what you get when you make assertions about the health benefits of religious devotion. If you suggest that religious devotion is good for your health, then you automatically imply that poor health may be associated with insufficient devotion. And that's simply unconscionable.
You know, in the interest of giving voice to a different perspective here, you know, there's a lot in the physical world that would seem like magic. I mean, the fact that when I'm on the beach, that the waves, ocean waves, come higher because of the gravity of the moon is, in some respects, just seems ridiculous. And the very idea of, take radio waves. I mean, the fact that your voice and mine is being carried in these invisible transmissions that penetrates people's bodies and their pets, but then a receiver can translate into sounds, would have seemed magical and absurd a couple of centuries ago. What about those who say that what's happening with prayer and spiritual activity may represent a level of science we just don't understand yet?
Well, it's certainly true that science progresses by new discoveries that may contradict the prevailing view. And we've seen that throughout the history of science. The view of the universe, the view of the position of Earth relative to the other planets in the solar system. In the beginning of the Christian era, the Greek view, the Ptolemaic view, was that the Earth was the center of the universe, and that was superseded by the Copernican view that the Earth revolves around the sun. We've seen revolutions take place throughout science. The problem is that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And the claims about the effects of distant intercessory prayer are quite extraordinary, but the evidence is far from extraordinary. And there is nothing that we know about the physical universe that can possibly account for how the prayers or healing intentions of someone in Baltimore can influence the course of patients in a coronary care unit in Los Angeles. There's just nothing we know about the universe that can account for that. Now, that's not to say that at some point we may not discover that there is something. We certainly will discover other things about the universe. But these kinds of extraordinary claims require absolutely extraordinary evidence, and the evidence is far, far from extraordinary.
Richard Sloan, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Richard Sloan is a professor of behavioral medicine at Columbia University. His new book is Blind Faith, The Unholy Alliance of Religion and Medicine. Coming up, David Bianculli on three new primetime TV series. This is Fresh Air. Three new primetime TV series are introduced tonight and tomorrow, scripted dramas on ABC and CBS, and a new quiz show on ABC. This week also brings the season finale of ABC's Dancing with the Stars and lots of other activity involving first-run weekly television shows. TV critic David Biancooley says all this action is related and little of it is cause for celebration.
Right now, we're just about at the halfway point of the November ratings sweeps. The sweeps used to be a very big deal in television. They were the times when all the broadcast networks agreed to set advertising rates for the next fiscal quarter based on audience levels they attracted during sweeps. So February, May, and November especially got to be hugely competitive blood sports. The networks used to show us all the big TV events then, from Winds of War to the day after. But sweeps months don't mean as much to advertisers as they used to. And they certainly don't mean as much to the networks. Not if you're watching the networks. The big broadcast boys, CBS, NBC, and ABC, threw in the towel years ago on big-budget, big-idea movies and miniseries. And in the entire sweeps month of November, there's only one special worthy of that title. Next Tuesday's NBC Tony Bennett special, directed by Chicago director Rob Marshall. Otherwise, what we're getting this month is the same old, same old. We're getting fresh episodes of current weekly shows. We're getting newer shows, rushed off the bench and onto the air, that are replacing the new fall shows that already have been canceled. And most of all, we're getting quiz shows, competitions, and reality shows. ABC's Dancing with the Stars presents its third season finale tonight and tomorrow, with either Mario Lopez or Emmett Smith waltzing away with the crown. Or tangoing, maybe. I'm not sure about that final dance. Also this week, NBC is pulling big money stunts on what feels like its nightly showings of Deal or No Deal. Both of these shows are extremely popular with viewers, and I confess to liking them too. Dancing because it's a live talent competition like American Idol, and Deal or No Deal because, let's be honest, it's about as mindless as a test pattern. The networks love these shows for different reasons. One reason is that when they hit big, as with Idol or Dancing or Deal, they can reverse the fortunes of a network. And even when they miss, they're cheap to produce and can be yanked immediately if they don't catch on. The Rich List, which premiered earlier this month on Fox, was pulled after one episode. And that was one too many. That's why tonight, ABC is preempting William Shatner and Boston Legal to present William Shatner as host of a new quiz show, Show Me the Money. It takes the similarly and scantily dressed women from Deal or No Deal and has them dance, as in Dancing with the Stars, while Shatner asks who wants to be a millionaire type questions to giddy contestants. It's hard to imagine a TV show put together more cynically or more ineptly. It's a train wreck. But immediately following the final dance-off on Dancing with the Stars, it'll get a big audience the first time out. By December, though, it ought to be thrown back where it came from, the bottom of the barrel. This week's two new drama series, at least, have actual scripts and actors who are acting rather than hosting. But they, too, seem to be put together with very cynical calculation. Tonight's CBS medical drama, called 3 Pounds, stars Stanley Tucci as a brain surgeon who's as brilliant as he is abrasive. If that sounds like Hugh Laurie's character on House, it's supposed to. Just as all the hospital staff romances are supposed to evoke Grey's Anatomy, an even more popular TV medical series. TV this season feels a lot like deja vu. Nothing feels more like it, though, than ABC's new drama series, Daybreak, which premieres tomorrow night. Starring Taye Diggs as a cop framed for murder, it's about deja vu. Specifically, it's like a dramatic version of Groundhog Day, with the character waking up each morning to the same events and trying to change them. Here's how Diggs, as the cop, tries to explain things to his girlfriend.
The day is the same, right? But different things happen, okay? It depends. Like, this lady at the coffee shop. One day I save her, next day she gets hit by a bus, right? You don't see? You don't see.
I don't see. This might be an okay concept for a movie. In fact, it is, coming out later this month, starring Denzel Washington. But as a weekly series, it doesn't make any sense. The hero is the only one in any real danger here. Everyone else can die, lots of them do, before the hero gets to reset his personal game clock and start all over. And then everyone else is fine. The last episode is the only one here that really matters. And that formula works only if the voyage offers drama as well as clues. On Lost, when somebody dies, they stay dead. One final point about déjà vu. We have seen one of today's TV trends before. The eager, greedy race to produce one quiz or competition show after another. That happened in the 1950s, and the popularity of quiz shows like the $64,000 Question gobbled up time slots that used to go to such valuable shows as Edward R. Murrow's See It Now. Only the quiz show scandals of that decade, proving that some of the shows were rigged, wiped out that TV genre as effectively as a giant asteroid supposedly wiped out the dinosaurs. But Who Wants to Be a Millionaire brought the quiz show back, and now it's taking over television again. The only way to stop it may be to pray for another quiz show scandal. Or a meteor.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhivar. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Casey Family Programs, a national foundation working to improve the lives of the 800,000 children who experience foster care every year at casey.org. From Capella University, an accredited university with bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees online. Classes start December 4th at capella.edu. And from Stuart and Susan Lucas. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, former vice presidential candidate and Senator John Edwards. He'll talk about politics, the 2004 campaign, and the next presidential race. He's edited a new book called Home, The Blueprints of Our Lives. I'm Dave Davies. Join us for the next Fresh Air.